Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello, and welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be here. Tay, how are you doing?
Doing all right. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Brooklyn. It's freezing cold again. Don't know what's happening with the weather, but at least the sun's out. Yesterday it was just ice and snow all day. Didn't leave the house.
Now it's frozen sunshine.
Yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that, I guess.
Yeah, we got 8 inches of snow here Friday night into Saturday morning, and luckily it mostly melted off the road because it had been 70 degrees on Friday, so everything was pretty warm when it landed, so it didn't cause a lot of problems. It's just cold as hell for a couple days, but starting Monday, 50s, 60s, and 70s, so I don't know. Hopefully that's the last of it.
I am just so ready. I don't know why this winter has bothered me more than previous ones. I feel like the previous ones have been a bit more compact. Like, it's cold and shitty when it's supposed to be cold and shitty, and then it gradually warms up. But this has just been such a rainy and wet and gross one that I'm just not about it.
And up and down, too. I mean, you have, like, each week is like 2 days of summer and 2 days of winter and 1 day of spring and 2 days of fall. you just keep getting pounded with all the different seasons in a week.
Well, and it's like it happens over the course of a day. I'm back to work now, and I had a long shift, and so I was like walking to work early in the day, and it was like 30. It was cold out, and I bundled up, right? Mm-hmm. And then over the course of like the 10-hour shift I had, where I got off at 1 a.m., it had gone up 20 degrees. So yeah. I get out of work at 1 o'clock in the morning and it's like warm out and I've got all these layers. I'm like, what happened? What is going on?
Yeah.
I don't know how to wear clothes.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, I don't know, maybe Thursday night or something like that. We went to bed and we were watching the 11 o'clock news and it showed the current temperature outside of 68 degrees. 68 degrees? It's going on midnight. How can it be that warm out?
I know, I wanted to stay up and take advantage of it, because it's like, well, it's going to drop back down to 40 when the sun comes up. I don't understand this magic that's happening.
Oh, I know. I hate those reverse days where you wake up in the morning and it's 60 degrees. They show you the high and the low. What you don't understand, though, is the high was at midnight, you know, that night, and it's only going to drop all day long. I hate those kind of days.
Well, hopefully, knock on wood, we're through the worst of it. We're going to have that mid-April snowstorm. That always happens. But, you know, hopefully for the most part, maybe we're moving into spring. So I thought we could talk about one of my favorite. It's good year-round, but I think it's definitely a good, like, spring aperitif, light, refreshing cocktail that I love very much. And that is the Kir.
Uh-huh.
Or the Kir Royale. It's like that kind of the two that you find most common. It's an incredibly simple cocktail, kind of right on the edge of what we can call a cocktail, because it is just, in the case of the Kir, it is just white wine, dry white wine with creme de cassis added to it, which is a black currant liqueur, and for the Royale version, that is just champagne instead, with creme de cassis.
I also think it's an interesting timing for this, because it's a drink that was born out of resistance of occupation, much the same as Ukraine is experiencing right now.
Yeah, that's true. It does. It has. It was popularized as an act of resistance. We'll get into if it was actually created in that. It's a little bit of a, like many cocktails, a little bit of a fuzzy history. A couple different people saying they did it, but it's definitely tied to World War II and resistance to German infiltration of France, which is very cool. But I think before we get into more about the cocktail, we should probably clarify what that, I think we all know what wine and champagne are, but the creme de cassis might be a little confusing for some people.
Yeah, I'd say of those three objects, of those three drinks, that's probably the least, the most obscure, the least known. Well,
and if we're going to go to the, like, what is wine? That's its own episode. That's a couple episodes. Right? That's,
yeah, at least.
Yeah. That's several episodes we've already done.
Yeah.
But creme de cassis, like, as I mentioned, a black currant liqueur, it is French in origin, and it dates back to the 1840s. It was first envisioned when Dijon cafe owner Auguste-Denis Lagoutte traveled to Paris, and he encountered a fortified wine liqueur drink called a ratafia de nuit, which was just like a macerated berries and spices and alcohol. And he really liked it. He was super enamored with this. So when he returned to Dijon, he set up shop trying to make his own fruit liqueur. And he turned to something they had in abundance in Dijon, which were blackcurrants. So he decided to base his liqueur around the local blackcurrants. Now, he had a couple years of experimentation, and finally settled on a recipe that was based in a sugar beet-derived spirit. So that means just that the grain alcohol or the pure alcohol came from distilled sugar beets, and then macerated blackcurrant, and then some additional sugar. Because as we've talked about before, when we have that creme de in front of something, it doesn't refer to cream, it refers to the sugar content. So it's over, at least over 200 like ppm, but up to like 400 in the case of creme de cassis. So just very high, sweet, viscous liqueur. And he also had one little addition that's specific to his, which was not just the blackcurrant berries, but the blackcurrant blossoms.
Hmm.
So like little flowers before they turn into fruit.
Yeah.
Now this is to pluck these berries. So you harvest like the actual fruit in like the summer, but the blossoms come previously. You harvest them in like the end of winter. And if you harvest them, that means that any of those plants will not give you fruit. So it's a bit of an expensive sacrifice to make to get the fragrant blossoms. You're going to lose all that fruit. An interesting kind of side fact to this is that these French blackcurrant blossoms are a prized commodity in the perfume world.
Huh.
Yeah. This is kind of gross, actually, because it's a very specific scent note in Chanel No. 5, but the thing that it attributes is a certain sharpness, and it makes me question Chanel No. 5. The thing it is compared to is the sharpness of cat pee.
Ah, well, that just sounds lovely. That makes me want to go out and slap on some Chanel No. 5.
And I guess also that's an element that they're trying to import into the creme de cassis, because you know it's a maceration and an infusion. So you macerate the black currants with the liqueur very gently and let it sit and settle. Then you filter it out, and then you also infuse it with the black currant blossoms. And I guess that gives you a bit of a floral note, and I guess a nice sharp cat pee note. I've consumed a lot of creme de cassis. I've never picked up on that specific flavor. Smell. Maybe I just don't have that good of a palate.
I think the advertising execs in charge of that failed big time, because that they should not have let that get out. They should have found something else that they compared that to, sharpness of cheese or something. I don't know, but not cat pee.
I know. I don't think that is on the bottle of Chanel No. 5, nor the bottle of creme de cassis. That is a weird esoteric like super smeller note.
Eau de fragrance le capi.
but I digress. All right. So he found out his perfect recipe scented with capi blossoms.
Recipe. Get it?
Yeah. It became a local hit, and the business really boomed when the railroad was built through his town, allowing him to export his creme de cassis not just to the rest of France, but also Europe at large. The railroad also brought another important thing into his life, and that was Henri Leger, which was the train conductor. Henri Leger would marry Lagoutte's daughter, Elizabeth, and sort of be introduced into the family business, take over. When Lagoutte retired, he helped take over the creme de cassis factory and sort of rebrand it, modernize it. And eventually the name for the Crème de Cassis was shortened to just Léger. And that brand is actually still around today, still probably the most prominent, like, most correct Crème de Cassis to use in classic Crème de Cassis cocktails like the Kir. So, yeah, they do other ones now. They do other fruit maceration similar to Crème de Cassis. Mm-hmm. They have like a whole line, but Léger is sort of the industry standard for Crème de Cassis in particular.
Well, I like some of the other crème de drinks, so maybe I would like that too.
Yeah, it's really, it's nice. It's black currant liqueur. It's very sweet. It's very berry. It's got nice tannins, and specifically Léger has those floral notes. Not picking up on the cat pee on my palate, but definitely some nice floral notes.
I would can truly say I would not know what cat pee tastes like anyway, so.
Well, I think it's more of a smell. Oh, okay. And I definitely know what it smells like. Unfortunately, I have a cat. I mean, fortunately, I have a cat. Unfortunately, the cat pees on things sometimes.
Yeah, animals would be all right if they didn't go to the bathroom.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
I don't know how you get one like that, though.
No, those don't exist. Now, back. That's Crème de Cassis, more or less. Let's get back to the Kir. As I mentioned, very simple drink, just dry white wine and cassis. The first iteration of the Kir was actually, it's attributed back to like 1904. And then it was just called the Cassis Blanc, which we understand the name, right? It's right. Cassis and Blanc for white. It was supposedly a creation of a waiter at 42 Rue de Montchapé, which is a popular cafe in Dijon. So this makes sense. You know, they would have had the dry white wine of Burgundy. They would have had Crème de Cassis because it's an export of Dijon. It would have existed by then. A waiter just put two and two together and served it and popularized it as an aperitif at this cafe. The drink really relies upon the balance of the dry acidity of the white Burgundy wine, the Aligot, and that cuts with the fruits and the florals of the cassis. So while like nowadays it's sort of made with just any wine or any white wine, it's you at least want to have in mind that you want something very acidic and very dry to go with the very sweet, very syrupy, very floral cassis. But in any case, it was a hit. And it eventually caught the attention of the who would become the namesake for the cocktail, and that was Felix Kir. And this is when we get into the cool Nazi fighting stories.
Yeah.
I love when a cocktail has Nazi fighting stories. That doesn't happen enough.
No, not nearly enough.
But that it happens at all is still pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds like a premise for an Indiana Jones movie.
Right. Indiana Jones and the Kir Royale. Yeah. Now, that sounds more like a James Bond movie.
It does. That's a combination of the two. Indiana Jones meets James Bond.
I feel like James Bond has probably had quite a few Kir Royales. It sounds right.
That's right.
Now, Felix Kir was an exciting guy. He started out as a Catholic priest, but he became a resistance fighter during World War II, when France was fighting against the German occupation. So in 1940, when Germans marched on Dijon, and most of the officials of the town fled, Kir stayed behind and helped free over 4,000 prisoners of war from nearby camps. And he fought with such fervor that he earned the French Honor Cross for his efforts.
Yeah.
And then in 1945, he joined the French Parliament and he became the mayor of Dijon, where he focused heavily on promoting regional goods, especially his favorite combination of two regional goods, which was the Cassis Blanc. So he had already been a fan of the drink, had been introduced to it. And as this represented both the wines of Burgundy, where Dijon is located, and this specialty of Dijon, which was the Crème de Cassis, it was a good combination of, like, this is something that we do in our town.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find it interesting, too, having been raised Catholic, that this French Catholic priest was allowed to run for mayor, because I've never heard of a priest doing that, and I actually thought that the church was against it. But now, maybe that's not the way it is in France, and maybe that's something that came along later, you know? I don't know. But I really thought that was unique, because I've never heard of a Catholic priest being elected mayor.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't know. I'm a bad Catholic. I'm not religious.
You're just a non-practicing one.
Non-practicing, I know. Yeah. Mom told me the other day that I was a cradle Catholic, so I can't escape.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so with his love of this drink, the drink became associated with Father Kier. And, you know, at first it was just called, like, oh, that's Father Kier's aperitif. And eventually it just became shortened to the Kier. So sort of locally was referred to with his name. And eventually Leger would actually ask permission from the mayor if they could use his name as the official name for the cocktail. And of course he accepted it. This was, you know, very like a nice fancy offering of like this company wanting to use your name as the drink to honor you. So he said yes, and he gave them like rights to use his name. He eventually gave rights to like everybody else in the region that was making crème de cassis. Like, you can all name your cocktails after me. Mm-hmm. So,
well, he was looking out for the region. But the other thing that I thought was very interesting out of this, and this was kind of his act of outward resistance too, was when the German troops occupied the area, they seized all the Burgundy wine. They got all the red wine and took that in because they liked the red wine coming out of there, and so they were taking all that, but they left the white wine. They didn't really think much of the white wine from there. So when you add the currants to the white wine, it kind of gave that a red look. And so, you know, then the Germans would be looking, hey, how are those guys drinking red wine? We took all the red wine. Where did that come from? Well, they didn't realize what they were doing was making that drink. So it was kind of an act of resistance, like, you took our red wine, but we're still having red wine. So what do you think about that?
Right. Well, yeah, and that was, you know, I ran across that story a few places, and some people were like, who knows how much this is like it's a great story, and it's definitely a story that came from, like, Father Kier himself. Mm-hmm. Was it, you know, that he just drank it like, haha, this is my Burgundy now, bitch? Like, who knows? But I like it either way. And I mean, you know.
Well, I like to think of him sitting there sipping on it, and the Germans, I thought we took all of that. What? Where did they get that from? Seize that wine at once. Where did you? It's magic. It was white wine, and now it's red. How did they do that?
Well, I mean, it's funny because the other story that's associated with, like, how it became so popular associated with Kier is just that after the war, there was a year of very bad white wine out of Burgundy. And in order to mask it, Kier helped popularize the Cassis Blanc as a way to, like, just, oh, this is the cool way to drink wine right now. But it was really just to help the winemakers sell off their not great white wine.
Yeah.
Because once you put in all the cassis, it masks it pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. Especially the way you made it back then. Like, as you were mentioning, it would have been that dark red. Mm-hmm. Because the old recipes we find for the Kier and the Kier Royale are like 3 to 4 parts wine to 1 part cassis. So that's, you know, a pretty heavy pour. If you're thinking like an ounce is like 3 or 4 ounces of wine to a full ounce of cassis being very thick, viscous liqueur, that's a pretty intense cocktail. We don't make it that way nowadays. Nowadays it's like a 10 to 1, you know. You want like a half ounce, maybe a quarter ounce of cassis in your glass of wine or your glass of champagne. You know, either way, and maybe both, you know, maybe it was a symbol of resistance. It was also a little troubleshooting to solve some bad white wine. Just something he really liked and helped spread it around with these cool stories so that other places around would buy it and export it and come visit and try it.
Well, it's not the first time that we've heard of that being the way that a cocktail came about, was masking a batch of whatever the alcohol was that wasn't superior, and so they mixed something else with it, and suddenly it tasted pretty good.
That's true. That's true. Most of the history of Prohibition.
Yeah. Necessity is the mother of invention, I think, is what a lot of the drinking history that we come across is attributed to. Yeah. How can I make this palatable? Because I need to get drunk.
And I mean, in any case, dude was a hero. So you know what? He's allowed to tell his stories however he wants.
Dude was a hero. Here's the other thing that amazed me when you think about the time period that he lived in. He was born in 1876 and lived until 1968. Now, 1876 seems quite remote to me, but 1968 was in my lifetime, so it doesn't seem like it's that long ago. The guy was 92 years old when he finally died. But when you think about what he lived through, the time period, two world wars, and you know, other things that were going on the planet. The guy just, I mean, was unbelievable. Plus, he was wounded severely in the war, and they thought he was going to die, and he survived it. You know, and he was in and out of prison camps and stuff like that because they would take him prisoner, and I don't know whether he talked his way out or the Pope intervened or what, but he would get back out again. So, I mean, he really led an absolutely remarkable life when you look at it.
Yeah, like, it's funny sometimes for these episodes, you know, I just kind of, I like this drink. I hope there's enough to get to talk about it because I like it. And then you get into the history and you're like, oh shit, like, I've been enjoying this cocktail for so long. I never knew there was, like, it's celebrating this dude that did some pretty awesome stuff. Like, it makes me really happy when you find something like that out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing sometimes. It's just a drink, you think, and then you look at what's behind it.
The first time, actually, you know, the first time I had a cure was in France. I was in Paris, and I was at somebody had invited me to a dinner party at their house, and we had it as correct, like, apéritif. So you have it before a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just hanging out and talking and, like, having little snacks, drinking cures. I was just so enamored with that experience and was just, like, early on, and, like, I was young. That was right after college. I was, like, 22. So I did not know much about alcohol. I did not know anything about drinking. I just thought it was the most magical, you know, I assumed incredibly complicated cocktail, not, but yeah, it took me till now to look at the history of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I sip on my limoncello now. That's my aperitif before dinner. I'll get my limoncello, pour my you know, 2 ounce shot of it and sip on that.
I love that.
I love that limoncello.
Italian dad.
Yeah. It's a good stuff.
All right, Lady Gaga. yeah, so that's more or less. This is all the history of the cure, obviously. The cure Royale, which, as I mentioned, is with champagne, I think is the one you encounter. That's the one I see more on menus. It's a pretty popular, like, light brunch drink, or, you know, you'll see it on simple cocktail menus. It's great. It's the one I prefer between the two, I think. But it does really rely on having, you don't necessarily need to use champagne, but I do think you need to have a good, dry, acidic, sparkling wine, because anything that's sweet is just going to play into the sweetness of the cassis. And you do want to, you know, you want to have, there are a lot of good brands of crème de cassis on the market. Léger is still out there. It's kind of the number one. But you do want to use something that is, you know, blackcurrant. A lot of times I'll see, and I was even taught this way at a bar once, and I just was like, well, that's wrong, but I'm not going to say anything. I see a lot of places use Chambord, which is great, and it is French, but it is raspberry liqueur. So not exactly correct in a cure royale, or in a cure. So, you know.
Well, I have seen where raspberries are often used as a garnish for it, though.
Yes. Yeah, and it's not, it doesn't, I won't say it makes an inferior version also. Like, I've had it made, a cure royale with Chambord instead of cassis, and it's really nice. It's delicious. And that is one of the alternatives, which there are a lot. Like, you know, in France, you'll encounter many, well, not just in France, really. You know, there are lots of plays off of this idea in cocktail history, none of which are as popular as the cure royale and the cure itself. But, you know, if you have it with peach liqueur, or with, you know, framboise with raspberry, there are variations just of other fruits that are all just like the cure and then the fruit. Like the cure pêche is the cure with peach liqueur. The cure pamplemousse is made with grapefruit liqueur. But there are some weird ones too. Like the pink Russian, which is made with milk.
Yuck.
Instead of wine.
I so would just not like that.
Cassis and milk.
Oh, man. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, like, I don't know, like, I like strawberry milk, you know, so maybe it's sort of like that.
Yeah, I don't know, though. When I'm mixing a cocktail, two things that don't come to mind for me are milk or cat pee. Neither one of those really are, you know, I think about when I'm mixing a cocktail.
What about both? What about both in a glass?
No, never thought of putting both in there either.
One that I thought sounded good is the Cidre Royale, which is cider instead of wine, and then they also add a little Calvados, so it would be Calvados, Cassis, and cider. That mm-hmm. sounds great. That sounds like a great light, you know.
Now, of course, for brunch, you think of mimosas, champagne, and orange juice. Would you say that the Cire Royale is a good substitute or something that you might want to try at a brunch?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think any... I prefer... I would prefer that. I like just, you know... And once again, like, we're dealing with, like, cutting acidity. When you do champagne and orange juice, it's just double up acidity, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love a mimosa for brunch in theory, but two or three mimosas at brunch and, like, all of that acid, it's, like, a little much.
Yeah.
But a Cire Royale, absolutely.
I've never heard of anybody ordering one of those at a brunch, so I don't, you know.
I've seen it on brunch menus, though. I've seen that, and I've seen, we've talked about the French 75 before, but like champagne cocktails that aren't just champagne and orange juice, I think do really well on brunch menus. And I mean, from practice, like I had, I mean, I guess now looking at it, it was very close to a Cire Pamplemousse because it's a Cire with grapefruit liqueur and it has to be sparkling wine. We had a grapefruit sparkling cocktail on my brunch menu at the last place I worked, and it sold great, but it was like, you know, less of a juice with a little splash of champagne and more of like an actual cocktail.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But yeah, but there's a lot of fun plays on it. It's a simple drink, you know, if you want to make, I think it's cool because there's cool history to both ingredients. Well, to both the cocktail and the ingredients in it. It is simple to make. You don't really need to have any expertise to make it. You just need, You can jigger it, but really you just need a little bit of cassis in the bottom of your glass and top it with your wine or your Prosecco or champagne.
Yeah, it seems really simple to mix, and you stick a spoon in there and stir it up there because it's with the cassis, cream de cassis being kind of thick, you want to stir it up real good.
Yeah, it will sit in the bottom. And as I mentioned, the proper proportions now, I don't say proper, the way we tend to make it now is less sweet than it used to be. So the color will work out to more of a blush, depending on what cassis you use. So you just, you know, nowadays it'll come out as more of like a pale blush color when you mix it correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's one of those drinks, too, that you can play with a little bit to see your taste. Maybe you like it a little sweeter. Maybe you like it a little less sweet. So you can add that percentage, you know, based on your own personal feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also going to vary cassis to cassis. Some of them, well, there's that base level that you have to qualify as a creme de of sugar concentration. Some of them have like double that amount, triple that amount even of like concentrated sugar in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, there are other really great brands on the market. They're actually, Leger went to court in like 1925 to get like an official definition of what creme de cassis from Dijon had to be to basically have some control over it, and they got that officiated. So it has to have a certain amount of local black currants, it has to have a certain concentration of sugar, it has to be a certain proof, and this isn't how what all creme de cassis has to follow. Creme de cassis is just an idea, it can be made anywhere, but creme de cassis de Dijon of Dijon has to be made in very specific ways, and there are four like brands that are allowed to make creme de cassis in Dijon right now. So it's like you know how champagne has to be made in champagne. Dijon, right. Creme de cassis has to be made in Dijon and has to be made this certain way. But they're all made slightly differently. So all of those that you come across will work out differently, especially in such a simple cocktail. They will all open up completely differently in your glass. So that's kind of a fun thing. If you like the drink, you can always experiment with a different creme de cassis or, you know, then branch into those other berry liqueurs too.
Well, there you go. The other name we kept throwing around there that I was interested to that if you didn't pick up on is Dijon. That's also where the mustard came from.
Oh, I assumed.
Yeah. Dijon mustard comes out of that area too. So those people have been working hard for centuries to bring us varieties of culinary treats.
You can just have a whole little brunch celebrating the exports of Dijon.
Well, I think Dijon mustard has white wine in it, doesn't it? I think it does.
I mean, or maybe it's what, like burgundy wine distilled into
something
into
like vinegar. That. Yeah,
usually mustard has vinegar.
Yeah,
I don't know. My mustard knowledge is not as thorough as my alcohol knowledge.
Well, I didn't get the in depth on it, but I did read where right. It is the area where the Dijon mustard originated. Yeah.
They got a lot of exports.
Yeah, yeah. Well, those people have been working hard there, try to find all those things to make the world a better tasting place.
Hey, they fought for it. They fought against the Nazis to make their mustard and their black currant liqueur.
That's right. Well, that was an interesting one. Tay had a little bit of everything in there.
Yeah, all sorts of history there.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend, if you like a good aperitif, it is a very classy and classic, simple to make drink. Not too high of a price point either, you know. A bottle of Leger's, and I know I can't remember the exact price. It's not exactly cheap, but it will last a long time. And I would recommend one. I think you should all check it out.
Oh, there you go. We'll have to try that.
All right. Well, thank you, Dad, as always, for being here.
Well, thank you, Tay, for having me. Once again, I learned something I didn't know.
Thank you all for joining us. Special thanks to our patrons over on our Patreon. If you want to check that out, we have extra videos, special rewards, all sorts of cool stuff. You can look us up on Patreon. We're Neat the Boozecast. If you want to hit us on social media, we are Neat Boozecast on Twitter and Instagram. You can email us at neattheboozecast@gmail.com. And if you want to talk about how you feel about Kir and Kir Royales or mustard, you can do that
on Facebook at Neat the Boozecast group page. We're there.
All right. Well, hey, thanks again. I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Neat. Yeah, I thought that dude was fascinating. Be a Catholic priest and all the other stuff he was involved in. Yeah, I mean, he was promoting his region and he was saving people that were captured and standing up to the German Nazis. He did it all.
Protecting his mustard.
Protecting his mustard. Save your mustard, buddy.